You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. My studio guest today is literary agent Rachel Calder. We've also got interviews with author Louise Foxcroft, and I'll be talking to poets John Lyons, Ian Diffenthaler and Maggie Harris about Creole. But hello, Rachel. Welcome to the studio.
Hello, Lee.
Literary agent. I'm going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment about your own background. But literary agents generally, historically, how long have they been around for?
Well, not that long in comparison to the length of time that printed books have been around, which is more than 500 years. Literary agents really started showing up in the late 19th century. There were sort of proto-agents before that. Jane Austen, her brother, looked after her sort of writerly affairs. He would deal with her publishers. Charles Dickens had a friend of his called John Forster, who acted as a sort of informal agent. John Forster, for reasons best known to himself, acted for other writers too, but for Dickens, he didn't expect any payment. Agents, on the whole, do expect...
They do now, don't they?
They do. They're paid by commission, or we are paid by commission. So the first agents started working in a sort of recognisable way, recognisable to us, way in the 1880s. A.P. Watt is generally regarded as the first British literary agent. There had been sort of others who had worked representing writers in some more formal way by now, but they've sort of disappeared from the record. A.P. Watt still exists as a literary agency. It's merged with a bigger agency now, but it still exists. You can look them up and you can be represented by them. My agency was started by someone called J.B. Pinker, who's actually an American agent who came to work over here and started his business in 1896. So my agency is very old. It's changed name every 30 or 40 years, but Pinker was the first of them. And he worked in a slightly different way to A.P. Watt. A.P. Watt he was legally trained, at least, if not actually a lawyer. And he worked as a broker between the writers and the publishers. And he would also broker on behalf of publishers for serializations with newspapers and magazines. So he would usually take an established writer who needed a deal doing and do the deal. Pinker would take on new writers, writers just at the beginning of their careers, like Arnold Bennett was one of his, and Joseph Conrad for a period, and try and build their career. And it's sort of Pinker's way of working that is the way that most agents work now. So he sort of established the method.
And is it a worldwide thing, literary agents, or is it very much a Western phenomenon?
It's mostly, or it has mostly until very recently, been a mostly Anglo-American thing. There's a similar rash of agents in America, and they started appearing at about the same time in the States in the late 19th century. Within Europe, it was different. Most writers did not have literary agents in the way that British writers and American writers did. They would sign a contract with their publisher, and their publisher would act as their agent for selling foreign rights or serial rights or film rights, on the whole. It's changing more quickly now, and more European writers have either agents in their own country who act, you know, in a familiar way to us as agents for them, or they have international agents in America or here. So it's beginning to it's changing, and it's changing more rapidly now. In other countries in the Middle and Far East, most writers don't have Anglo-American style agents, but that'll start changing again too, as their industries, you know, evolve so much more quickly than art. I mean, ours took 150 years to get to this point. Theirs, I think, will develop more rapidly than that.
And things like self-publishing, how does that affect agents? Are you finding that you've needed less or
well, no, thankfully. I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say needed more at this point, but certainly not less either. It's different. I mean, quite a few agents, including myself, have some writers who come to me to do some business for them, do contracts for them, to sell some rights and some books for them, and other books which they think are either too niche or they're sort of road testing a new series or something. They can that they would prefer to self-publish until such a time either as the series or the idea has sort of gained enough traction that they feel a mainstream publisher will support them to a greater degree than they would if they went with a slightly less evolved idea. So, I mean, I know that there are many self-published authors who wouldn't go near an agent or a old style, you know, traditional publisher because they just don't need them. They feel they don't need them. And that may serve them very well, and great, that's what self-publishing's for. But I think most agents are finding that that career writers who want to make a career of it, not necessarily a living, but a career, that it's an important thing to them. They want to write. They don't want to be their own business manager. They don't want to have to be tweaking their social media profile, although we encourage writers to do that anyway. They don't want to be seeking new opportunities with publishers overseas. They want to be writing. So it's broadened the field, certainly. I don't think it's taken away the importance or the role of an agent. Agents do more than just make deals for their authors. We, you know, read manuscripts over and over again. We sort of talk in great depth as to whether the direction the author's heading in is a good one, a right one, or not. Chase payments, advise on, I mean, all sorts of things. And the addition of self-publishing as an option feels like an additional set of opportunities, that doesn't really cut anything off.
Well, we'll come back to more about what you'll do and what your role is, but we're going to hear your first piece of music now, which is The Cape by Guy Clark. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose this?
Only being able to choose a few songs to play and to talk about is a terrible agony for anybody who has to do it. So each of the songs sort of have to stand for 100 other songs that couldn't be played. So this one stands for my children, my family, and because it's the song, as you'll hear, is about a child who is being observed by his parent, and it is a boy child in this case, as being sort of full of hope, and that thing that young children have, that they think they can do anything, including fly. And he may or may not be right, and the song doesn't sort of cut off the idea that flying may not be a great idea. So, I mean, it's sort of, it's about, you know, it makes me think of my children and that maybe they can fly if they try hard enough.
Well, now, this is a song about jumping off the garage. Flower sack cape tied all around his neck. He climbed up on the garage. He's figuring what the heck. Screwed his courage up so tight that the whole thing come unwound.
That's The Cape by Guy Clark, the first choice of my studio guest today, Rachel Calder. Rachel has run the Sale Literate Agency in Cambridge since 1993. The agency represents British and international writers such as Billy Bragg, Kate Pullinger, Michelle Spring, Annie Prue, and the estates of Brendan Behan and Henry James. Rachel is also a trustee of the Writers' Centre Norwich and the Cambridge Literary Festival. Rachel, I suppose, really, for people who don't know, you should perhaps give a brief précis of what a literary agent does.
Well, we We act as a business manager for writers, negotiating contracts, reading first drafts of the book's proposals, helping put proposals together, putting ideas together to present to publishers, stamping on ideas that shouldn't be encouraged for one reason or another, helping maintain their backlist, giving them opportunities where possible to try out new ways of writing if a novelist wants to see if they can write a screenplay or the other way around. Then the more dull things like chasing VAT payments, arranging tax exemptions, chasing publishers and newspapers and magazines, whoever it is, for payments, trying to get books. I deal entirely in books, not in the film and television side. To get the books translated into foreign languages, translated into other formats, film, television, stage, almost anything that's to do with the writer's business, the business side of the writer's life, really, once the book has been finished, really, or to try and help them get it finished. So it's sort of very broad but quite specific at the same time.
So you're a middleman a lot of the time between the publishers and the writers. That must be quite a difficult road to tread. Could you want to stay friends with both? You're representing one and you need the other one on your side as well.
Yes. Actually the middleman role is less fraught because it's not, because you are there to be the to be the not the sponge, the there's a word that I can't quite think of, but the thing in the middle that absorbs the force from one side and the force from both sides, actually. Representing the writer, I act for the writer. I'm work entirely on their side, but they're not always right. And so it's sometimes translating what the publishers are saying for them in a way that makes it acceptable, hopefully, whilst trying to demonstrate the terrible, sometimes hard, sometimes facts of publishing life, which may seem unfair and outrageous, but nonetheless they exist. It's the territory, the circumstances which their books are having to deal with. And publishers usually like authors to have agents because it's the agent acts as a sounding board for both sides. So if the publisher thinks the author is being uncommunicative or difficult over something in particular, then the publisher can talk to the agent and the agent then can talk to the author and vice versa. So you do hear it from both sides. You always have to represent and advocate for your author. That's the person on whose side you are, always. And if you don't feel like you should be, then you might need to question your representation. But the publisher isn't always wrong, and they're not the enemy. They're the professionals who are meant to be bringing the book to the reading public, and so you need them. You're not really on the author and the publisher are not on separate sides either. But there are huge areas of where mixed or bad communication can cause a situation that needs diffusing, and the agent certainly tries to do that.
So you're the kind of communicator, really. So if the publisher wants the manuscript changed, you're the person who communicates that and communicates any resistance back the other way.
Yes. It's not only a sort of a negative role in that we're not only pulled in when things go wrong, but when things are going swimmingly, there's not much need for an agent to interfere, so we try and step back. So if the manuscript is delivered and the editor thinks it needs heavy revision, the author thinks it needs light or no revision, then yes, the agent would need to step in and sort of negotiate a settled agreement. But if the manuscript goes in and and it needs heavy revision, but the author agrees, then I leave the editor and the author together to sort it out. Because for them to have a good, strong relationship is really important for the success of the book and for the author's sort of happy experience of being published. So I don't have to stand there as guard in both directions. And that would, for an agent to do that, would cause additional problems. They really need to know when to step back and let the process, the author and the publishers, get on with publishing the book. And if there's a problem, then yes, we would come in and try and help sort it out. But always acting in the interest of the author.
And in the case of where you, I mentioned there, you're representing the estates of authors no longer around. What's your role there?
Well, it depends on the individual estate. Some estates eventually do fall out of copyright. And in some of the really old estates, we only maybe represented one or two books. So it's slightly, there's less to do for those. Some estates are very complicated. Even where we did represent more than one or two books, we represent the Brendan Behan estate, or other parts of the Brendan Behan estate. And in all these cases, it was for the books that were published. So in his case, we didn't have anything to do with his theatre and stage work. But we don't necessarily have all the information. But where we do, we just make sure the books are kept in print and reprinted as necessary. We represent a new estate like the Sheila Delaney estate. So that's a case of making sure that as many of her plays and stories are kept in print and republished. We're trying also to sort of raise her profile in a number of ways, trying to have people broadcast about her, write about her. You know, so there's some sort of non-specific things to do, like raising of a profile, but the main job is to try and keep as many of the books, as many of the works in print as possible.
Thank you. Well, speaking about books from the past, or people from the past anyway, Louise Foxcroft is a writer, historian and broadcaster. She's written books on dieting, the menopause and addiction. Her latest book, The Irish Passion, tells the riotous and at times controversial story of Pum Geir Anderson, an Egyptologist, surgeon, psychic and poet, amongst many other things. The Irish Passion was launched with Unbound Books, a crowdsourcing publisher. But when Alex Rouget met Louise, she asked her first how she found Anderson.
His family are local still in Water Beach, and he lived in Suffolk for a long time and was back and forth to Cambridge. It was purely serendipitous, but it led to Geir Anderson's grandson, and he has all the archives. He's got the unpublished journal, he's got the letters, the diaries, the pictures, a lot of the artefacts, and was looking for somebody to write the life story.
So you must have been delighted when you found out you sort of to uncover him. You're like, wow.
I was completely thrilled, because it came with a good recommendation. It was actually my old PhD supervisor who said, there's this terrific story here. I met Theo, completely charming. I read through their memoir, which is something like, I think it's 11 volumes and it's 130,000 words. It's his whole life story. It's a memoir because it was written at the end of his life, shortly before he died in 1945. And it runs from his birth in the 1880s through his extraordinary Victorian childhood, detailed. It's quite cruel, and it's a peculiar mix of the loving and the cruel. The whole family went from Ireland to America to take part in the land boom in Kansas in the 1880s, which his mother had a pistol in her bustle, that sort of thing. The most extraordinary stories. Back to Ireland, he entered Guy's Hospital as the youngest student and finished his degree in the earliest possible time you could. Soon as he came out as a surgeon, joined the army and was posted to the Middle East. And then the most of the story is about his life in Cairo and the Middle East during all through the First World War and through the 20s. So he fought at Gallipoli, he was there when Howard Carter opened Tutankhamun's tomb. The stories are spectacular.
So the biggest challenge must have been deciding what to leave out, in a way.
Well, it was, and it was quite frustrating, because in some areas where you think, get more detail, I need more detail, he skims, and then other areas where he's particularly, you know, caught up in something, you get a lot of extraneous detail. So it was a sort of pruning exercise, plus finding context for the particular event. So his period in Gallipoli, where he concentrates mainly on finding, he has an identical twin who's also in Gallipoli, and he meets him. So there's a small sort of vignette about their meeting and their relationship, which was quite intense and not always smooth. So I read widely about Gallipoli so I could fill in some of the context, you know, the geography, what he was doing there, what the hospital ships were doing. In other areas, there's plenty of his own information. So I had to contextualise, especially some of his attitudes needed putting into context.
And so did you find other sources of people who had opinion about him, or, you know, people from his time that had written about him? Because if someone so flamboyant must have made an impact on others.
Well, he's very flamboyant, but I think there were other people living that sort of life then in various different guises. I don't think it's the sort of life that gets lived now. But also, he wrote it all down, which is, you know, not many people do that. In some ways, he's quite peripheral, so he was quite private. He works for Kitchener, he works with T. Lawrence of Arabia. One of his friends is Eric Gill, the sculptor. He knew the Spenders, Humphrey and Stephen Spender. You know, so there's plenty of quite well-known figures, various different walks of life, but he himself is quite peripheral, but he writes about them. A cache of letters turned up recently in Cambridge from Edna Clark Hall to Geir Andersen's twin, Tom Geir Andersen, and they are quite illuminating about personalities and how they are. But they're about the only extraneous accounts of him as a person.
So for people who don't know, I mean, first of all, you alluded to it just now about his early life. What do you think made him the man he was in terms of his unconventional upbringing and his parents treated him?
His mother loved him greatly. So he has a good deal of the idea of what love is, but finds himself unable to love, as he says. His father was extremely strict and quite an odd, obsessive, difficult man. So those two relationships are quite formative. As a child, he asks his mother why she didn't protect him from their father's excesses. And she was obviously quite scared of the father too. So that's quite central. His relationship with his identical twin is very central. So there's a sort of duality that goes straight through his life. So he's split almost at birth. And he leads I don't think it's too strong to say he leads a double life, because on the one hand, he leads a very respectable public life, very successful, respectable public life, but quite a, some might say, deviant and racy private life. And those two have to be kept separate because of homosexuality, of course, is illegal until the mid-20th century. So there's lots of compartmentalisation, there's lots of secrecy. Mm-hmm. So it's partly his family life, it's partly his intimate relationships, and it's partly society and the way society was structured and law that dictated how he conducted himself.
And when we talk about the racier side, I mean, do you feel, looking back, you know, did he step over the line in terms of the way he conducted himself and his relationships?
I don't want to be anachronistic about it, because, it's no good imposing today's attitudes on something that happened, 100 years ago. I mean, obviously, some of his activities were against the law, but, you know, the law is an ass on occasion, isn't it? I didn't want to be judgmental, so what I did, I wrote the book, I based it on the memoir, and I just gave everything a sort of almost equal value.
Mm. Was it difficult for you knowing that it was a controversial subject? I mean, you are writing in the context of today, and those subjects are...
Yeah, it was quite difficult, but only in as much as I wanted to do it justice, and I wanted to do it properly, and I wanted to be careful to be non-judgmental about his completely honest feelings and the way he was, and he wasn't alone in the way that he felt and he thought and the way that he behaved.
In terms of his relationship with his twin, can you talk to us about that?
Very intense. They were very alike. Their house in Lavenham in Suffolk is now a museum, and if you visit there, and I recommend visiting, there are life masks of their faces, and it's really hard to tell them apart, and it's quite extraordinary to come up against the 3D, you know, photographs are great, but the life masks are something else. He did quite a few of those himself. It was very intense. it was generally agreed between the two of them that Pumgeir Anderson, who I'm writing about, was the softer and gentler and more sensitive of the two. Tom was a harder, more forceful character. He comes out very well in the letters from Edna Clarke Hall, the illustrator, and he comes out very badly in the diaries, letters, and a Romana Clay written by the woman who had Pumgeir Anderson's son, John, by arrangement. So he was obviously quite a difficult character. They were, between them, fascinated by the intimacy that they had, and they would quite often turn up wearing the same clothes. They would quite often be able to finish each other's sentences. There were one or two what they call psychic adventures where they see each other or can speak to each other or feel what each other is feeling. But it obviously fascinated them both, and it was not always an easy relationship by any means.
When you talk about the psychic side of things, I mean, Pumgeir Anderson was someone who believed in ghosts.
Yes, oh yes, yeah, but they're brilliant little stories where there are two or three very detailed and graphic descriptions of people that he had seen who were dead or were introducing him to someone who was dead or that he spoke to, that he walked around with, that sort of thing. There's one where he is, I think he's in Gibraltar at the time, and there's a knock on the door and he looks out and he sees himself knocking on his own door and rushes downstairs. It's not his twin isn't there. But he's interested in magic and superstition, Egyptian magic and Egyptian superstition. And he has what he calls his psychic adventures, where he is drawn to a particular artifact or Egyptian piece, somehow magically drawn to it, and then it has different connections within the rest of his pieces or the rest of his life. So he likes cohesion, and he likes to find connections between things and people and incidents, and he thinks of them as psychic incidences.
Mm. Having spent so much time with him writing this book, and obviously you don't want to be judgmental, but how feel about him?
I'm very impressed by him. I have a great deal of respect for him. I'm impressed by the way he worked. I'm impressed by the way he was adventurous and incredibly brave. He went round the Sudan for Henry Welcome and for the British government, collecting and investigating the sleeping sickness. He got lost in the desert. He wrestled a crocodile. He fought at Gallipoli. He's very intense about his loves and his loyalties. It's a very difficult period for a man like him. So whatever you think about some of the decisions he made, a lot of them are made under duress. I think he's admirable and exciting.
That's Louise Foxcroft there talking about her book, The Irish Passion. My studio guest is literary agent Rachel Calder. Rachel, that's a non-fiction book that Louise was talking about there. You represent non-fiction as well.
Yes, I do.
Is it a different process when you're representing a non-fiction writer?
Yes and no. But with fiction, the books, when we submit them, are usually finished and polished. With non-fiction, often they're not. They're not even written. They're often we're submitting proposals partly because it takes a fiction writer. It can take a fiction writer many months, years to write as well. But publishers seem to be more forgiving of it's that they can see that a good idea from their point of view for their publishing company, as long as it's written reasonably straightforwardly, the idea is what will sell the book. So a book on, you know, how to train your dog, or about a scientific breakthrough, or about a biographical figure like Louise Foxcroft's subject, the publisher can see how the book could work out, and there'll be a detailed proposal and some sample chapters as well. And they can judge on that. Whereas with a novel, the book can the writer can present an absolutely brilliant idea and some sample chapters and a breakdown of the plot. But with fiction, it really has to work on every page, and there has to be a magic there in the writing and in the sort of finished version that is very hard to predict. So with nonfiction, we're normally dealing with proposals and ideas rather than final manuscripts. But other than that, it's more or less the same, yeah.
And that magic that you talked about in fiction, when you're reading a manuscript, do you know straight away? And how quickly do you know that this has got it?
Yes. I know straight away whether I think it's got the magic or whether I think it's got magic that works on me. and every agent would say the same. What that magic is quite hard to pin down, and whether that magic, it'll be different for each person. Some people feel the magic only when they read crime or science fiction, others only when they read literary fiction or only romantic fiction or general fiction, which is, I mean, all these categories are unhelpful in lots of ways, but they but they're necessary because publishers and booksellers have to be able to put. I mean, but one of the reasons for these categories is that booksellers have to put books in certain parts of the shop so that people know where to find them, but they don't necessarily serve the works so well because they can you know you can put. It can feel like books have just been put in the wrong. That, you know, this isn't really a science fiction. This isn't really. This is, you know, it's better or bigger or.
And those books that cross genres.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I mean, so the categories are a bit annoying. However, then they are necessary. I forgot what you said.
The magic. What is the magic? But yeah, what are you looking for when you read a manuscript?
Well, if you ask anybody in publishing, any editor or any agent, they say they're looking for a voice in the right. This is for fiction. It works for non-fiction as well. And sometimes they're looking for a voice, a fresh voice, a fresh look, a fresh way of looking at the world. And that's what a writer with the magic brings. There are only so many stories to tell, you know, love and loss, voyage out, you know, there's a fair few of them, but there is still a sort of limited number. So what every writer brings to these stories is their own perspective. What in the combination of experience and imagination and other stuff, magic, that's in their mind. I've heard other people describe it as music. You know, they're looking for music in the writing. Quite hard to define what that is, but you know it when you see it. Now, what every agent and every publisher will say is that when they started reading this new manuscript that landed on their desk, they just knew immediately it was going to be a huge success. I'm a bit sceptical about that because they usually say that after it's been a huge success and they're sort of thinking in hindsight. But what I absolutely do believe they mean is that they felt there was something, that some magic that worked on them. And then the publishing process had to try and make as big a success of it as they possibly could. And there are, you know, history is full of the sort of decaying bodies of books that didn't quite take off. Which doesn't mean they didn't have the magic for that agent and that editor. It just meant that the book didn't somehow get its fair chance, or the piece of good luck that came, or who knows. I mean, each one will have its own story as to what happened to its publication. But the individuals involved, the editor and the agent, will have been absolutely convinced that that book had the magic when they read it. So recognizing the magic or seeing the magic in manuscript just means that you love it and you want to do everything you possibly can on its behalf. It doesn't necessarily guarantee a success, unfortunately.
We're talking more about magic. Yes, trying to capture that magic. We'll play your next track of music now, which is Bruce Springsteen in the River. Why have you chosen this?
Well, I've always loved it. I was rather astonished to find it was recorded in 1980, which seems like such a long time ago. But I loved it then as a sort of story of, you know, infinite possibilities in this romance, which had soured by the time the song came to be written. But there's a line which I'd still like best of all, which is a dream a lie if it don't come true. And I think absolutely not. I mean, the dream was there. He had the dream. It didn't quite work out. But this is a sort of analogy for writers too. That not all their books will fly. But that doesn't mean they were wrong to write them, or we were, you know, wrong to try and, you know, push them as hard as we could.
I come from down in the valley where Mr. When you're young.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
I
Yes, welcome back to Bookmark. My studio guest is literary agent Rachel Calder. But we're going to shift gear slightly at the moment to look at the Creole language. Earlier this month, I went to the Saison Poetry Library at the Royal Festival Hall in London to hear discussion about the Creole language and how it's used in Caribbean British poetry. But before the talk, I managed to grab some time with poets John Lyons and Maggie Harris and publisher Ian Diffenthaler. I started by asking Ian, who runs Cane Arrow Press, a major promoter of work by authors from Trinidad and Tobago, I started by asking him exactly what Creole is.
It's a coming together of a number of African languages with English. One of the features of colonial society was the intention of the colonial masters to erase all the languages of the enslaved peoples. Inevitably, they retained certain elements of their grammars, which then came together with an English syntax. So what you have is something that sounds like English, but it does have grammatical constructions that come primarily out of West Africa. But then on top of that, in some territories like Trinidad, Grenada, St. Lucia, you have the influence of French. This is further complicated by the arrival of Indian languages. Other things like that, Chinese, Syrian, Lebanese, all come together. And it is the language that most people speak when they're speaking to each other. It's based on English, but it's just broken up. It's fractured with a number of different grammatical constructions from other places. It used to be what was called bad English when we were at school. So, you know, you weren't allowed to speak that kind of English when you were in class. Linguists now recognize it as a language in its own right, with its own grammar and its own rules and its own constructions. I suppose more recently it's become a point of identity of what used to be known as West Indian people, but I see the tendency now is to call people Caribbean or...
Perhaps if I can ask you, John, it's Caribbean British. The Caribbean always comes first, does it?
It's a very difficult question to answer, really, in terms of Caribbean coming first. Because if I had been in England for a long while, but as I said to you before, I actually try to retain my spiritual and cultural ground. And for me, it's both, really. I do love the standard English. I love words, I love the way things are structured and all the rest of it. But at the same time, I have the feeling for the Caribbean sort of culture and language. And especially when I hear my calypso, I want to dance. I go straight back into what I'm used to. And for me, it's wonderful to have both, really.
Does the Creole offer you something that the English doesn't?
What it offers me, the Creole, is a different rhythm. Because the body language is there as well. I mean, see, if I'm speaking, if I meet one of my friends, and we gesture. We have a body language to go along with the words and so on. And you feel good about it all. Being in this country for such a long time, actually having to teach in schools and colleges and so on, I couldn't go and speak Trinidad language. Hey man, you boy, learn your work now. I couldn't tell him that. I say, behave yourself now. Hey, what are you doing? I couldn't speak. I had to sort of speak standard English so they'll understand. But in my poetry, I delight in actually using both. I always make the distinction. Now I'm going to read poetry using Creole and stuff, you know, which I love.
Do you think it's a particularly poetic language?
I think it is, in fact, because we go right along. We go back to a lot of sayings, for instance, like two man rat can't live in the same hole. Husband and wife, you know, if they're arguing. I've got a poem about that, actually.
Are there essential elements of the language, do you think? You know, can you identify certain characteristics of it?
Yes, in the words we use, definitely. I mean, say, you know, we go back to, as I used the word mama guy earlier on, I'm not absolutely certain where it's come from, but I know it's a hybrid, and I know there's sort of certain things related to those French. And I always remember my cousin when she came to Trinidad for the first time, and she was living with us, she's my cousin, and my father was coming up the road. I suddenly heard her say, "Uncle, I come." And that took me by surprise. You know, "Uncle, I come," you know. And, you know, it's pretty obvious what she meant, but it's a different sort of way of speaking, yes.
You're talking today about the creolizing of language and culture. What does that mean?
It refers to what Louise Bennett called colonization in reverse. So we're talking about feeding in various West Indian Creoles back into, as it were, the mother country. Now, with the West Indian Creole comes a culture. So that culture is mixed into whatever mainstream English culture is. So you get a clash of cultures. They begin to mix. and you begin to have a sort of accommodation between the two. And that accommodation produces all sorts of interesting and unexpected effects in terms of language, in terms of rhythms, in terms of cultural nuances. So it's got all sorts of possibilities which a more settled language probably doesn't have. It's constantly changing and evolving.
I know that Kay Narrow are particularly keen on publishing Caribbean poetry, Caribbean British poetry. Why is that? Is that your personal interest?
It's my personal interest. And I started it because there is a dearth of publishers in Trinidad, and there's very little Trinidadian poetry published. So I wanted to redress that balance. A key interest of mine and the subject of my thesis, actually, was this reintegration of West Indian poetry into Britain. You know, we may branch out into short stories, probably, but for the moment we're going to stick with Caribbean, British and Trinidadian poetry.
And have you seen an increase in awareness about this kind of poetry or popularity over the years?
I think there is much more interest in all forms of hybrid Englishes, if you like. And especially with the advent of what people call spoken word, there is a coming together of the Caribbean basin, jolly old Britain, and America. So you have rap culture and various poetic devices from Black America, which feed into the language. So it is seen as, in some quarters, as hip and happening. I'm not sure for us old folks, but I think it still provides, you know, numerous opportunities for linguistic tricks and ways of conveying messages that perhaps you couldn't do in the way that poems did when we were at school.
What do you mean by that?
I think the most famous characterization of that was, I think Kamau Bradford said that the hurricane does not roar in pentameters. That is not to denigrate what Keats, Shelley and Byron were doing, but he was just suggesting that a new language had emerged with its own rhythms, its own meter, if you like, which was good enough to stand on its own feet and offer a different set of possibilities.
Are there particular motifs or images that are associated with the Creole language and with Creole poetry?
But there's certainly a coming together of grammars. There are certain rhythms that you find in Trinidad, especially in some calypsos, you will find a stacking of words.
Are there certain motifs and images from Creole that you use?
Me personally, I go back to the folklore and the legends. I'm very much interested in that aspect of language. In fact, it goes just beyond the language, you know, in terms of where people perceive things and the way that they speak. As you know, for you'll find in my poems, there's the certain characters like the Sukunya, the Jumbi bird, you know, they're very important to me because, in fact, that gives colour to language in Creole, really. When I write poems about that aspect of my culture, I write it not in standard English, but I write it in Creole.
Can you read a poem for us?
The one that I talked to you about just recently, I delight in actually taking standard forms and, I would say, perverse, being, you know, working all up again, but I use my own. This is called Who Wears the Trousers, this particular one. And it's using the triolette, which is a standard form, but I'm using my own rhythms, and I'm also using Creole or Nation language. Two man rat can't live in the same hole, so you better pack up your things and go. I don't know what make you so bold, but two man rat can't live in the same hole. Because you think I look fat and old, you could flatter me, so I say yes, no. Two man rat can't live in the same hole, so you better pack up your things and go. And he answers, "Ame God, this is belovedness. It ain't no hole. It's always the fun place where honey does flow. I admit sometimes I just lose control, but cockot, this is belovedness. This is no hole. It's not nothing, doo-doo, darling. You may be fat and old, but I always doing my best to show you, cockot. This is belovedness. This ain't no hole. It's always be fun place where honey does flow." So there's a repetition coming in. It's a particular form which I thought will fit very, because here two man and woman, they're arguing about something. She's trying to get him to go away, and he's answering back. So I'm using, usually it's an octave of eight lines with rhyming patterns, but I put the two poems together and to make it an argument.
You've got a poem, Maggie.
This is the first Creole poem I ever wrote, so I'll just do an excerpt of it. And it's called The Limbo Walkers. I sit down with my father by the river. He dead, we know that. The Burbies water's wetting, he feet, not mine. I point my finger across the other side, traveller them lining up and waiting. The water she licking them toe slow. Some brave already. Them I have followed, see they can walk upon the water. They lift their head up high like sugar cane, them spirit rise up high, straight up to the sky. I turn, watch my daddy. He say, it's the limbo walkers them.
That was Maggie Harris reading some Creole poetry there. Before that, John Lyons, and before him, Ian Diffenthal, publisher, Cane Arrow Press. We're running short of time, Rachel, very sorry. I don't know where the hour's gone, but I am conscious that there are people perhaps listening to this, writers, who want to know how to present themselves to an agent. What makes a good impression on you, and a bad impression, I suppose, for that matter?
Well, there are... right and wrong ways to approach an agent, and the wrong ways are with an unfinished, unfocused, messy looking manuscript, and this is either on printed paper or an electronic email submission that is then sent to the wrong agent. In other words, an agent who isn't interested in that kind of writing, whatever it may be. So the first thing would be to make sure that the writer has done their research. They know who they're sending it to. Dear Mr. Agent, especially if it's a woman agent, will not make them any friends. Dear Joe Bloggs is fine. Dear Josephine Bloggs is fine. Dear Joe is fine. Most people these days in sort of office environments are pretty informal. So a first name's fine, or a Mr. or Ms. whomsoever is fine. Send the first three chapters, especially if it's a novel, not chapter 6, 9, and 12. Seeing how the book works, how it starts rather, is really important, because if you can think about how a manuscript will make its way through a publisher's office, it comes to the editor first, who opens it on page one and starts reading. And if they like it, then they will acquire it. But for their colleagues that in the sales and marketing department, in the production department, in publicity, they will also start reading at page one. So those first impressions are really, really important and can make or break the opinion that the reader will make of it. Where, especially in the sales and marketing departments, they have hundreds often of books to try and convince their colleagues on the bookselling side to support. So again, they will often only read the beginning section. So if the beginning section is full of stuff that has nothing to do with the real story, the story doesn't really get going until page 50, then that whole sense will have been lost. So make sure your book starts at the very beginning. Make sure you send the first three chapters, and the first three chapters are as clean and polished and clear as you can possibly make them. Write a brief but sort of professional-looking covering letter. Dear so-and-so, this is my book. It's about this. I wrote it because whatever. A paragraph is really more or less all you need. An outline, a reasonably detailed outline about how the rest of the book develops after the third chapter. That's more or less the ideal package.
Okay, yeah, it makes sense really when you think about it. Just, you're being professional and courteous.
But also if they put themselves in the shoes of the people who are going to be receiving it, what do they think they need to know to make an instant, a quick first impression? And that first impression will last, so it's important to give them the best possible chance for your book.
Well, thank you, Rachel. Thank you very much for coming into the studio today. Our next show, my studio guest will be nun-turned-author Eleanor Stewart, so I'll have a lot to talk to her about as well as Michael Rosen. He'll be talking about his new book about humanism, and Amir McBride talking about A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. We've just got time to squeeze in your last track, Rachel, which is the wonderful Tank Park Salute by Billy Bragg. Why this one?
Well, it's a beautiful, lovely, heartbreaking song. In the first place, I love most of Billy, or all of Billy Bragg's songs. He's known mainly as a protest singer, but his sort of love songs and tender songs are the ones that there are more of them. But that's not how he's sort of represented. But it's just a beautiful, lovely song.
Say my prayers, leave the lights on at the top of the stairs. Tell me the names of the stars up in the sky.